an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show, coming to you over the Radio Ear Network. You probably certainly know that, and you probably certainly also know what time it is wherever it is you are. It's 1 o'clock here in beautiful Sarasota, Florida, which is where I am lucky enough to live these days. And as I said, this is The Lynn Show. What you're going to hear, if you listen to The Lynn Show, is the various things that I know about, care about, and am interested in. And I hope that they are things that you also care about and are interested in. So some of what you hear on these shows will come from my book called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And other information that I've learned over the years from my psychotherapy practice and my consulting career. And also you will hear songs from my CD and from the CDs of some of my friends. Some of the music that you hear here you won't hear anywhere else, but I hope that you will like it. And so I'm going to begin now with some information that is neither in the book, actually, nor on the CD, but that I think is really important when you're wondering about why you might be doing things you would rather not be doing. Last week, I talked about the myths that we believe about change and how believing things that are not true get in our way and influence us. Today, I want to talk about brain chemistry. We rarely think about the impact that what's going on in our brain has on what we are able to do and what we are not able to do. But in fact, our brain, the firing of the neurons in our brain and the chemicals that it drops into our bloodstream is profoundly affecting how we act, what we can do, what we think we can do, what we think we're unable to do. We are, as a species, creatures of habit. We don't really like change. I know it's popular these days to talk about loving change and embracing change, but as a species, we really don't want to. We want to do what I like to call putting as much as we can in the I don't have to think about it box. There is so much that we have to process every day, so many complications, that everything that we can put in the I don't have to think about it box simplifies our life. And I don't have to tell you that every day, every week, every month, our life becomes more and more complicated. More and more things have to be thought about, figured out, evaluated, planned, learned. I am, at this moment, experiencing this learning curve as this is the first radio show I've ever done. And if you were listening 2 weeks ago, you heard my very first radio show, and I talked about that then. I talked about the challenge of doing a radio show and the learning curve that is required for it. And now I have the learning curve of using this software in my computer because I'm pre-recording this show. We are not coming to you live. So in addition to making sure that I have enough stuff to say to fill up an hour, I'm having to learn to work this new program. And I'm dyslexic. So this sort of thing, the technology, is challenging for me. And a new learning. So as I was saying, we're all confronted more and more and more with new things that we have to learn to do. And the more things we don't have to pay attention to, the easier our life is. And so we put as many things as we can in the I don't have to think about it box. It's spontaneous. It's autopilot. And our brain helps us with that. I think about the brain as the world's most labor-saving device. It learns so many things for us, and then we don't have to think about it. So, for example, if you're driving along the road and the light at the stoplight turns red, you don't have to think about whether red means stop or go. Long before you have processed the question, your foot's on the brake. Your brain has associated red, light, stop, and you stop. It doesn't come in for calculation, evaluation, analyzation. It's spontaneous. Our life is filled with these things. Things that we do over and over and over again that we don't have to think about. Many years ago, I had a psychotherapy client, who worked for one of the intelligence services. And he told me that if you ever want to find somebody, all you ever have to do is follow them for one day. If you follow somebody for one day, the chances are you will always know where they're going to be, because we're creatures of habit. So we wake up at the same time, pretty much. We have our coffee in the same cup. We sit in the same chair. We drive to work along the same route. We take lunch at the same time. We generally even eat in the same restaurant. We may even eat the same thing for lunch every day with the same people. We go to the same coffee shop on the way home. We stop at the same grocery store. We're programmed, really. Because if we had to stop and ask ourselves every day, do I want to drink out of this coffee cup or that one? Do I want to eat in this restaurant or that one? Do I want to have this meal or that one? We wouldn't be able to get out of bed. There are so many decisions to make. And when we want to break one of these habits, we can feel the resistance inside of us. I had this experience. I actually did gave this experience to myself to test it. I live near the beach, and I drive to the beach, and I park almost always in the same parking space if it's available. And then when I step onto the beach, I have the choice of turning right or turning left to walk. On my particular beach, there's not a lot of beach left to the right. It runs out. So I turn to the left and I walk. I can walk for a very long time. That's how I do it. I get on the beach, turn to the left, and I walk. I went to a convention in another beach town, and on some time off, I went to walk on the beach. And I thought to myself, well, I'll test this. Instead of making the left turn on the beach, I'll make the right turn on the beach. I did. But I could feel my body saying, this is wrong. We're not supposed to be turning right. We're supposed to be turning left. When our feet are on the sand, we're supposed to be turning left. Well, obviously, I could make my body turn right. And for the days that I was at the convention, I turned right. And then when I got back to my home beach, I wanted to turn left, and I did. But I promise you, I could feel the resistance in my body. We are programmed to learn as many things as possible and not to have to think about them. And that, as I have been trying to say, works to our advantage. It makes it possible for us to get through our day doing the kinds of routine things that don't require thought and reevaluation and alteration. But, as you can perhaps see, when our brain has learned something wrong or something that was right at one time but now needs to be changed, there is resistance from inside of us. This is where the brain chemistry comes into play. Our brain, or more specifically the neurons which fire in our brain, tell us what to feel. A neuron fires and drops a chemical in our bloodstream, and that chemical makes us feel something. It makes us feel happy or sad, frightened, angry, anxious, excited, etc. When the chemical enters our bloodstream, we feel whatever it's telling us to feel, and then we make decisions about what's going on in our world based on what we're feeling. For example, if your brain drops the fear chemical into your bloodstream, you're likely to feel scared. And when you're scared, you assume you must be in danger. You may not be in danger, but if you're frightened, you assume there must be danger, and then you behave as though it were true. Unfortunately, sometimes our brain makes mistakes and drops chemicals which are not appropriate to the situation into our bloodstream. And then we make decisions which are not appropriate to the situation. For example, if you were bitten by a dog when you were a child, it is likely that the fear and pain that you experienced at that time comes back whenever you see dogs later in life. It may be translated into a sort of mild dislike or an avoidance, or you may just say, I'm somebody who doesn't really like dogs. Or you might actually be frightened when you see dogs. Even though the chances are good, most of these dogs are not dangerous to you. The chemical that's gotten dropped into your bloodstream and tells you that you're frightened also tells you that these dogs are dangerous, and you behave accordingly. This is often what's happening when we want to do something and our brain tells us we should not be doing it. It does this by dropping a chemical into our bloodstream which makes us sad or scared or resentful, or somehow makes the thing we want to do appear to be scary or threatening or just ugly. So it was with Christine. She wanted to ask for a raise at work. She deserved it. She knew she deserved it. Everyone knew she deserved it. But her boss was stonewalling her. All she had to do was ask. But every time she thought of asking, her throat closed and her stomach felt like she'd just been on a particularly nauseating carnival ride. Why was her brain dropping these chemicals into her bloodstream? Why did it want to stop her from getting the raise she worked for and deserved? It didn't seem to make sense, and it really worried and upset Christine. Eventually, in therapy, we discovered the reason. Christine's mother was a loud and bossy woman who was always afraid that Christine was going to embarrass her. Christine had one very painful memory that occurred when she was 5 or 6. She and her mom had gone to a little friend's holiday party. There were presents for all the children. The children drew numbers to see who would pick first, and Christine got number 1. She was so excited. She ran immediately for the biggest present and grabbed it. Her mother yelled, "You put that back immediately. You don't just grab for the biggest present." Christine dropped the present and took something small. This was not the only time in her life that Christine's mother told her or showed her that it was bad or ugly to ask for what you wanted. And Christine's brain learned the lesson. If you ask for what you want, you will be humiliated. And so even though she clearly deserved as well as wanted her raise, the chemical that dropped into her bloodstream whenever she thought of making it stopped her. Obviously, in this case, Christine's brain learned a lesson which was incorrect to the current situation. And in this way, we're not so very different from animals. Apparently, if you tie a baby elephant to a tree and it learns that it's stuck, when the elephant grows up and is big and strong and could tear down pretty much any tree, if you tie it by a string to a branch, it won't try and get away. When you have a powerful experience, an intense experience, or you have the same experience time and time again, the brain learns to associate that experience with the emotion that has been generated by it. They say that when neurons fire together, they wire together. So if in the future you have an experience that is similar to, resembles to, or very close to the experience you had when you were young, the brain will fire the appropriate chemical and drop it into your bloodstream, even if, as in Christine's case, or in the case of the poor elephant, the lesson it learned is incorrect to the current situation. Alan's experience is an example of this. Alan's mother was an alcoholic and a rageaholic. She terrorized her young son. He lived in fear of her depression and her rage. He was vigilant, ever watchful, to see what Mommy wanted or needed. Inevitably, he failed her and was punished. Then Alan grew up, but his relationship with his mother never changed. With a word or a look, she could get him to do anything she wanted, and she took full advantage of the power she had over him. Now, although grown and married, his mother routinely calls him and asks him to do menial things which she could clearly do for herself. And even though he doesn't want to do these things, he feels compelled to comply. He spends too much time jumping to her requests, and he sacrifices his time and his relationship. He cannot resist her. He wants to say no. He feels an overwhelming sense of guilt, under which is a fear he doesn't always acknowledge, and so he rushes to do whatever she wants. Finally, he became able to resist the impulse to call and check on her, to see if she needed anything, to be, as he says, the good son. But after a certain period of time, the memory of her sad face and her betrayed-sounding voice would occur to him, and that memory would generate a powerful sense of guilt. She didn't even have to be there doing it. He could manufacture her in his brain and then react as though she had called and laid that guilt on him. The brain, unfortunately, can't tell the difference between what is actually happening and what is remembered. So when Alan remembers his mother's sad face and the depressed voice, the part of him that experienced her abuse knows that a terrifying punishment is about to occur, and he reacts appropriately. Alan doesn't know why he can't resist her outrageous requests. He's angry at her, and he's angry at himself, but he can't stop. Now, as a married man who's contemplating having a family of his own, he wants to break that chain that bonds him to his mother. But the feelings are so strong, and the apprehension that something terrible will happen if he defies her is so intense that at 40, he's begun to dread the phone ringing for fear it will be his mother and she will wield this power over him. Like most of us, Alan has forgotten or buried the abuse that set the neural firing in his childhood. And so this behavior makes no sense to him. He berates himself as a fool and a coward. So, Are there things in your life that you want to do very, very badly but are unable to do, no matter how much you promise yourself that you will? Or maybe there are things that you continue to do, like Alan, that you really wish you could stop doing, but somehow you simply can't. Perhaps a neuron fired in your childhood, and you are at the mercy of the chemical dropping into your bloodstream. Knowing this, knowing that that's what's going on, can help a lot. It doesn't necessarily change behavior, and I will talk more and more about how you do that, how you change brain chemistry, no easy thing. But knowing that that's what's going on can make you feel much, much better about it. At least then, you're not yelling at yourself, saying, I shouldn't be doing this. You're understanding the powerful motivation for this behavior that you would perhaps prefer not to have. So now I'm going to take the opportunity to play a cut from my CD. This is one of the advantages to having a show of your own. You get to be able to play your music, and that's what I'm going to do right now. So I'm going to play what is probably the silliest song on the CD. It's called Which Way Is Out. I wrote it a very long time ago, long before I became a therapist and long before I began to do yoga, so I'm making fun of both of those professions in it. Little did I know I was going to have to live with that. Anyway... I hope you like it. Here it is.
I went to see the doctor. He lay me on his couch. And as I talked of dreams, he put my money in his pouch. Whoa, whoa, which way? Which way is out into the sunshine or out into the rain? You know that I don't care who else is there, long as they don't claim to be sane. I went to see the guru. He sat me on the floor. And now my body just won't do the things it did before. Whoa, whoa, which way is out? Which way is out into the sunshine or out into the rain? You know that I don't care who else is there, long as they don't claim to be sane. Mama smiled, said all the while, there's nothing wrong with you. Whoa, whoa, would that were true? Please show me out into the sunshine, out into the rain, 'cause I don't care.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to The Lynn Show. And if you tuned in during the music that was just playing, you are listening to a cut from my CD, which is called I Won't Go With a Whimper. And that song was called Which Way Is Out. If you haven't heard the show before, let me alert you to the fact that not only that I play music, but also I talk a lot about why we human beings cannot make the changes we want to make in our life when we want to make them. A lot of the information that you hear here will be coming from my book, which is called When You Can, You Will, Believe It or Not. And today I'm talking about brain chemistry and how the chemicals that are dropped into our bloodstream by the neurons that are firing in our brain stop us from doing things that we might want to do and make us do things that we would prefer not to do. I'm going to tell you a story of an example from my own life now. When I was about 5, my dad, who was very proud of his new motion picture camera, shot some footage of a TV commercial. Now we're talking about the late 40s here, and the TV was this tiny black and white thing, and the commercial was this woman sitting on a chair holding a product, and it was very dark. I remember it still. My dad used to show us cartoons. He had all of the, you know, he had a projector and he had a screen, and he would put the screen up in the living room and we would sit down and watch cartoons. It was wonderful. I can still remember the smell of the screen. Anyway, this time we all got into the living room and he showed us the footage of this commercial. And as I said, it was very dark and it scared me. And I remember that my aunt was there with us, and I must have been showing that I was scared, and my aunt, in the way that adults sometimes do, said, "Oh, no, no, don't be afraid of it. It's nothing to be afraid of. Go up and touch it." And she pushed me towards the screen. This was very scary in me. Of course, I'd forgotten entirely about it, and now we fast forward 20 years, and I'm at a discotheque in Manhattan, and there are strobe lights. It was very hot then. And everybody's having a great time, and I'm terrified. It took me a long time to put together that the flickering lights of the strobe light reminded me of those early motion picture that early motion picture film that my dad took, and my brain, that wonderful labor-saving device, had remembered that this kind of flickering, this kind of black and white, dark and light, was scary. And so here I am in this completely undangerous situation. Everyone else is having a grand old time. But my brain remembers that this is a scary thing. And it dropped into my bloodstream the fear chemical. And so I was afraid. I tell this story to my clients quite often so that they can have an example of this going on. If I even remember the strobe lights or that picture of that woman today, I can feel the fluttering in my stomach that says, ooh, ooh. Now, knowing that this is all coming from an early neural firing, even when there wasn't any danger there, allows me to be in the presence of strobe lights and not to run screaming from the room, and not even to feel the full-blown fear. It interrupts the fear response. But I had to know it before I could. Otherwise, it was just too uncomfortable for me to be in that place. When I tell this story to clients, sometimes later they will, when they're about to tell me an example in their own life of a neural firing, they'll say, well, I guess that's my version of strobe lights. Can you think of an example from your own life that's an example of strobe lights? That's a reaction that you're having that doesn't make sense, that might, just might, be linked to a firing of a neuron long ago in a situation which you may not even consciously remember? Okay, I think it's time we take a little break. This is very, very dense information. And if this is the first time you've heard anybody talking about brain chemistry and the impact that it has on our behavior, this can be a lot to take in at one time. because this information is so difficult to capture the first time you hear it, after we take this break in which I'm going to play music, I'm going to do a recap of what I've been saying about brain chemistry. So if you hang in there, you can hear a little recap of it at the end of the show. I'm going to do three songs that were produced by a very influential, very important record producer who died last month. His name was Joel Dorn. He produced Roberta Flack and the debut album for Bette Midler and just about every important jazz artist that was performing while he was recording. I have a connection to this because in the early 70s, when Joel was producing both Roberta Flack and Bette Midler, I was hanging out at Regent Sound, which is the recording studio that he was recording at, and I was hanging out there so that when everybody went home and the sessions were over, I was able to record piano vocals of the songs I was writing. I was just beginning as a songwriter then and was lucky enough to have access to this studio and would and as a result, I got to hear some of these sessions, and even when I didn't actually hear the session, I got to hear what had happened after they were over. I have also, I was there during the recording of Killing Me Softly and First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, and Bette Midler's Do You Want to Dance, all three of which I'm going to play for you. And the Bette Midler thing is particularly meaningful to me because years before that, I saw Bette Midler at the Improv in New York. And at that time, she was sitting on the piano doing 30s and 40s songs, and I remember she did My Forgotten Man. She was just unbelievable. Unbelievable. She was so powerful. But she wasn't the divine Miss M. She wasn't the divine Miss M until that debut album that she did with Joel. And that really launched her career. So I'm going to play those three songs, which have meaning for me and probably for you. They were so important, those songs. So such big hits. So maybe you remember where you were when you heard them for the first time. And as I said, when I come back, I'm going to do a recap of the information on brain chemistry. But now let's listen to the magic that Joel Dorn could make with these amazing artists. First time ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes, and the moon and the stars were the gifts you the dark and the endless skies, my love, to the dark and the end of the skies. First time
trembling heart of a captive bird that was there at my song, telling
Today, I've been talking about brain chemistry and the effect that it has on our behavior. More often than we might realize, we're reacting not to what is actually going on in our life, but to what our bloodstream is telling us about what's going on in our life. The neurons which fire in our brain drop chemicals into our bloodstream, and those chemicals cause us to feel certain emotions. And then we make decisions about what we should do based on the emotion we're feeling. If, for example, the chemical which causes anger has been dropped into our bloodstream, we feel angry, and we will behave then in an angry manner. The problem with this is that sometimes, maybe even a lot of the time, our brain is dropping chemicals into our bloodstream which are inappropriate to the situation and causing us to react in an inappropriate, maybe even counterproductive way. This is because, in an attempt to save us time and energy, our brain learns that certain situations require certain responses. And if a situation in the present resembles a situation in the past, the brain will immediately drop what it has learned was the correct response chemical into our bloodstream. But as the next example makes clear, the current situation, even though it resembles the past situation, may not require the chemical that the brain learned was appropriate. A small example might be that as a child, you were left alone in your room during a very violent thunderstorm. It is likely that today, thunder, even mild thunder, scares or makes you uneasy. A more serious example might be that you had parents who would fight, and when they fought, they might yell and scream at each other, and you were frightened by their loud voices. So whether you're aware of it or not, as an adult, you may shy away from loud voices, and you may not understand why you're unable to stand up for yourself if somebody yells at you. Couples often find themselves in unpleasant exchanges, which are caused by one or both people experiencing neural firings, which tell them that they're in jeopardy, or being attacked, or being dismissed, when actually this isn't happening. But they're certain, because they're feeling attacked or dismissed, and that forces them to act in ways that makes the disagreement worse. Selma had a raging father who would scream at her and then hit her. Over time, however, as afraid as she was of her father, Selma learned to sass him, talk back to him, and even verbally attack him. Selma married John, a big man who, although gentle and would never, ever think of harming Selma, had a big voice. Whenever they got into a disagreement, even about the smallest things, things which neither of them really cared that much about, John would get excited and raise his voice. The sound of his loud, masculine voice would trigger Selma's brain to drop the fight chemical into her bloodstream, and she would begin to verbally attack him. John's parents were very demeaning of him, and hearing himself attacked, John would try to stop Selma's abuse with abuse of his own. Before you knew it, they had turned a small skirmish into World War III. The worst part of this was that although they actually loved each other very much, over time they began to question their love for one another, and then to wonder if they should stay married. I believe that many marriages suffer from this misconception or misconceptions like this. Many disagreements and even divorces can be blamed on mistaken neural firings. Today I have been talking about brain chemistry and how the chemicals that are dropped in our bloodstream by the neural firings of our brain make us believe things that may or may not be happening. And because we believe these things, alter our behavior. But the brain also affects our behavior in other ways. By the way, it's wired. For example, I'm dyslexic. I'm very, very, very dyslexic. I'm dyslexic in a lot of ways. I didn't know that until I was, God, in my 30s, I think. because, of course, they didn't have that term when I was growing up, so it was not diagnosed. And I believe that I compensated for this dyslexia in a number of ways. One of the ways was to pretend that I could do what I couldn't do. I did that a lot. But I think another way in which I compensated was by developing my memory. I couldn't learn the way other people learned, so I memorized. Luckily for me, I had that capacity. I'm pretty sure that's how I got through school, including graduate school. Because I am one of those people who reverses numbers and letters. If you're giving me your telephone number and I'm repeating it as you're giving it to me, my brain can be saying one thing, my mouth another, and my hand is writing something else. And it's quite remarkable to see that you're, you know, I'm repeating it as you're saying it, and my hand is writing something other than my mouth is saying. It's amazing. I don't really see what's on the written page. Mostly I see what I expect. So I can't edit or proofread my own writing because I don't see what's missing. I'll leave out letters, I'll leave out words, but I won't see that. I'll see what I expect to be there. This is a fascinating thing for me that the brain will do that, because it's not that there's something wrong with my eyes. I learned about this, again, I think in my 30s. I was in a restaurant with a friend, and I said to her, what are you going to have? And she said, oh, I'm going to have the special. I said, the special? What's that? And she pointed to the menu, and there, big as life, is this box that's highlit. Well, I hadn't seen it. And that's what happens. Now, if you point it out to me, because as I said, there's nothing wrong with my eyes will see the thing. But if, and I don't know what it is that my mind chooses to ignore. Although it seems that the more highlight it is, the more likely it is to disappear on the page, which is pretty funny because it is precisely those things which people are trying to make jump out at the page at you. My brain is very stubborn, and those are precisely the things I won't see. I don't have visual memory. If I meet you at a party and we talk for an hour, and I meet you on the street later or next week or something, I will not remember your face. But if you tell me what we talked about or you remind me that we met, then I will remember virtually everything you said to me, but I will not have visual memory of your face. It won't stay unless I've seen you several times. It's been very embarrassing to me, as you can imagine. When I was a kid and I wanted to make some food in the kitchen, my mother would say, fine, you know, go ahead, just put everything back where you found it. God, I remember that so clearly. Well, of course I couldn't do that because I didn't have visual memory of where anything was. So if I took the ketchup out of the refrigerator, unless I say to myself now, and of course I never did it then, I have taken the ketchup from the second shelf at the right, I'd go back to the refrigerator and open it up and have no idea where the ketchup went. Perhaps you can see that this is problematic. But again, I have figured out how to compensate for that in my life. Another way my dyslexia demonstrates itself is geographically. And I really thought I was the only person in the world who had this and that nobody would believe me if I told them. But I've met several other people who have it too, so I guess it's a syndrome. If I think the right direction is to turn right, if I think that's the correct way to go, inevitably it's left. I don't know why this is, but it's so consistent. And as I've said, I've now met two or three other people But interestingly enough, they're all women. I don't know if any men have it. Well, maybe they wouldn't admit to it even if they did, but... So when I told somebody this once, and he said to me, well, this is easily fixed. You know, when you think the correct direction is right, you just go left. And I thought I would try that. I couldn't make myself do it. My brain was so clearly telling me this is the right direction that I went that way. But it wasn't the right direction. It was wrong. It's almost always wrong. Unless it's a route I really, really know. If I'm going there for the first time or I haven't gone there very often, I'm going to do it wrong. So I bought a car. It didn't have GPS, but it has a digital readout with north, south, east, and west. So if you give me directions now, the car will correct me. And that has made a lot of difference in my life. But the most important difference has been my willingness to stop pretending. To admit to myself and to everybody else my limitations, which, as far as I can tell, are hardwired in my brain. My friends know about my geographical difficulties. Whenever I have to go anywhere, people will say, "You follow me, Lynn." Or if I'm supposed to be somewhere and I call up, they say, "Where are you? We'll tell you how to get here." And people are really kind about my problem. But the really important piece is that I am no longer wasting my time, my energy. I am no longer feeling that there's something wrong with me. I want to offer this to you. If you have hard wiring from your brain that is making you do things that you think the rest of the world can do and you can't, or if you're having neural firings, chemicals are dropping into your bloodstream that cause you to act in ways that you would prefer not to, really the most important thing you can do for yourself is to accept it, to be willing to be who you are right now. There are some things we can change, and then there are some things we cannot. I believe that my dyslexia, as I said, is hardwired, and I simply have to live with it, and it's not worth feeling bad about. In terms of the neural firings, in the next show, I am going to talk about how you can begin to alter neural firings, to change them, so that you're not so much at the mercy of things that seem to be taking you over. But more than anything, what I want to say is that much as we might wish it weren't so, we can't do what we can't do. It's just the truth. If you can't do it, you can't do it. But when you can, you will.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night.
Like some